Good afternoon, everybody.
We'll call this, I won't call the meeting in order. We don't quite have a quorum yet. We will get started, though. We do have our presenters here today. Commissioner, thank you for coming. If you would want to approach the testifying table, that would be great. Today we're going to be hearing from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency with the budget overview. So again, welcome, and please state your name for the record as well. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Tingerthal. I am Commissioner at Minnesota Housing, and next to me is Ryan Baumtrog, who is our Assistant Commissioner for Policy and Community Development. Thank you very much for inviting us back to present our budget package for this year. We had the pleasure of meeting with this committee about 4 weeks ago and providing an overview of the agency, so we've tried to keep just the overview comments fairly brief. We do have a PowerPoint presentation which should be available in your packets. So just to remind you that at Minnesota Housing, our mission is to finance affordable housing for low moderate income households while we foster strong communities. And the strong communities part of it is very important to us, working with local communities to make sure that the dollars are coming into communities in ways that are useful to them. To remind you, our sources of funding are quite varied, and you'll see down in the lower right-hand corner that state appropriations make up only about 7% of our current year programmatic spending plan. And if you look down on the very far right lower item, the total funding amount, that's our programmatic funding, that's all the dollars that will go out into the community for our current federal fiscal year, is $953 million. So the state appropriations in this plan are about 7% of that. Up in the upper right-hand corner of the circle, we were fortunate this year to also receive state bonding authority through housing infrastructure bonds and general obligation bonds, and those investments have all been placed already. The general obligation bonds will be announced tomorrow at our board meeting. The vast majority of the funding that we utilize is in the blue, and that is the sale of federally tax-exempt bonds and access to other mortgage capital. We use that primarily to support first mortgages on multifamily properties and our single-family mortgage program. Federal funds represent federal rental assistance that we administer for the state on behalf of HUD. I might also note that we do put agency resources into our programs. About 8% of the resources are actually amortizing loans. We, for example, make our home improvement loans off of our balance sheet, so we call those agency resources. And finally, about 3% of our overall spending budget is from agency resources for deferred loans, so those are loans very patient capital. Reminding you also that state appropriations, no state appropriations at Minnesota Housing are used for agency administrative costs. All of the dollars that are appropriated to the agency go directly into programs. In terms of dollar amounts that are in our budget, 56% of those state appropriations serve households with very low incomes, below about $12,000. And 61%, inclusive of that 56%, serve households with annual median incomes below $19,500. So some of the lowest income households receive assistance through our Housing Trust Fund and our Family Homelessness Prevention Program. That breaks down on the next page, slide number 5, into uses. About 50% are for rental assistance, about 20% for home buyer programs, another 19% for our state-funded homelessness programs, and smaller percentages for rental production and home improvement programs.
Excuse me, Commissioner, we have a question from a member.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm just wondering, on the bottom of page 2, the slides that tell the median household incomes, do those incomes stated there include any public assistance that folks might receive, or is this outside of public assistance?
Commissioner Tinkerthal.
Mr. Chair, Representative, those do include any sources of income, so Social Security, disability income, et cetera, would be included in those amounts.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And would that include, is Section 8 considered income, Madam Commissioner?
Commissioner Tinkerthal.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, it is not considered income. It is considered rental assistance because it is paid directly to the owner of the property on behalf of the tenant based on their income.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
Representative
thank you.
Scott.
And Commissioner, I'm still not clear on the numbers. The aid to family with children, is that considered income?
Commissioner Tinkerthal.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the MFIP program is, in, if someone is receiving that income, is included in these income figures.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Please continue, Commissioner.
Slide number six, again to remind you that in terms of program delivery, Minnesota Housing does not ourselves own or operate any housing. Nearly all of the assistance is provided to individuals through private delivery partners. So that would be lenders in terms of our home mortgage program, developers and property managers in terms of our rental properties, and social service providers in terms of our rental assistance programs. And the programs are accessed by those parties through a variety of delivery methods. We run a consolidated request for proposals process. That's a competitive process that is scored every year and awarded on a competitive basis. We typically have about three times to four times as many requests for funds as we are able to award. There are a few programs that we are able to keep available, such as our mortgage lending program, on a pipeline basis, so anyone can go to a bank that participates in our program and borrow at any time of the year, typically. Our impact in 2014, we helped nearly 60,000 households. That included more than 2,700 units of new affordable rental units or existing rental units that were rehabilitated. 2,700 mortgages, about nearly a quarter were to households of color. And just to give you an idea of how the program compares, the median income for home buyers, since you need a certain amount of income to afford to pay a mortgage, is $50,900. So all in all, the program year that we completed on September 30th of last year, we did put $754 million worth of resources into the community. So you'll see that with the addition of the housing infrastructure bonds, our budget for this year is quite a bit larger than it was in the previous year. On the next slide, slide number eight, we have a continuum of housing programs that reach from homelessness prevention to affordable home ownership. So starting where we think it's very cost-effective benefits, preventing homelessness before it begins. This is our Family Homelessness Prevention Program, and it provides small grants to families to help them with things like down payment assistance, security deposit on an apartment to prevent them from needing to spend a night in a shelter. Supportive housing is permanent housing for households that have experienced homelessness. And this is housing that comes along with services. We have a number of different service models, the services being provided by social service agencies, providing things like mental health assistance, chemical dependency assistance, job training, etc. Affordable rental housing, that's housing that has rents that are established at levels affordable to families up to a median income of 60% of median income. and this is for new construction, acquisition, or rehabilitation of rental housing, including workforce housing. And affordable homeownership is primarily for first-time home buyers. It also includes home improvement loans for people who already own their homes and some modest amount of single-family development of properties by developers that are then sold to households with low and moderate incomes. This takes us then to our proposed budget for the coming year. And we did go through this with the with several people from this committee previously, but I'll go through it just briefly. Our budget in fiscal year 14-15 total was $101 million. That included several one-time appropriations for our housing and job growth initiative and two rental assistance initiatives. And some of those dollars were increased into the base budget for 2016-17. And so our base budget coming into the year was at $98 million. The governor's recommendation is for just slightly more than that, with an increase in the Bridges program of $2.5 million into the base and an increase of $250,000 into the capacity building base. So just a very modest set of increases. I'll talk now about the workforce housing that we have funded out of our Economic Development Housing Challenge program, known as Challenge for short, which has been a resource for communities since 1999. If you turn back for a minute to page number 9 with the budget, you'll see that the Challenge program is our largest program, and it is also one of our most flexible programs. We have used that program since 1999 to provide assistance for workforce housing located throughout the state, and the rules for the program do require that there be a local match requirement when those funds are used for at least 50% of the projects that are funded from that fund. In greater Minnesota, just to give you an idea, from 2010 to 2014, we developed 382 units of new affordable rental housing and 368 new units of home ownership. The challenge income limits, just so you're familiar with them, are for rental housing, $58,000, and that's available no matter what community you're located in, and for homeownership development projects, up to $82,000. We also use other resources for workforce housing. We do receive and administer the federal home dollars, housing infrastructure bonds, low-income housing tax credits, and all of these do also support housing development in greater Minnesota. I know that this topic is of particular interest to this committee, so that's why I've gone back to highlight that again. In low-income housing tax credits, which is a federal resource that we allocate on behalf of the state, since 2010, that's helped with 830 units of new construction housing in greater Minnesota. Getting then on page 12 to the two changes that are recommended by the governor to the agency's base, $2.5 million for the program that we call Bridges. This is literally a program that bridges for people with serious mental illness an exit from a segregated institution such as a state hospital to a community setting. And it provides rental assistance for a time period while that household may be on a waiting list for a Section 8 voucher or other rental assistance that's funded by local housing authorities. And to qualify, the household must have at least one adult that has a member that has a serious mental illness. With that as the target population, it serves households with incomes below 50% of median in the metro. That's below 41,000. In greater Minnesota, below 36,000. With the additional dollars, we estimate that we will serve an additional 200 households. And I do want to point out that this program plays a very important role in the commitments that the state has made under the Olmstead Implementation Plan. This is something that we've worked very closely with the Department of Human Services on, because it's important when we're providing the rental assistance that these same individuals also receive the necessary counseling and other mental health services in their new location that they need to live successful lives. And we are counting on these commitments to be able to work with DHS on their program, which there's been some publicity on, of really trying to reform our mental health system in the state of Minnesota. The second change in the budget is $250,000 additional in the capacity building line item for our budget to support the development of the homeless management information system. This is a system that's been in place for about 10 years, and it is at the heart of the system is a reporting software which is required for reporting on roughly $39 million worth of federal assistance that is received each year to support people who are experiencing homelessness. So in order to continue to be eligible for those dollars, we are required to use this system for that reporting. What has also been the case is that agencies, state agencies, over that 10-year period have found that in order to make sure that we're not duplicating services for individuals, that we're doing effective referrals of individuals from one service, one center to another, have found it's useful for them to manage their information also on the HMIS system. We have recently completed an examination of this system and have received actually some federal technical assistance in order to do that examination. We now have a game plan for really improving that system so that it can be more effective at making sure that we're not duplicating services and that we're targeting resources in the most effective manner. And so this appropriation would assist us in doing that work in the next year. We have also recently retuned the governance of the Homeless Management Information System, which includes representatives from state agencies as well as groups out throughout the state that are called continuum of care organizations, which represent the various organizations that manage homeless resources out in your communities. So we're very hopeful that with the groundwork we've done that we can quickly implement some changes to this program. Finally, in the governor's budget changes, we're recommending three reallocations. In the 14-15 base, there was $540,000 for capacity building. That was for two organizations, one for an organization called Homeline, which provides dial-up assistance for people who are experiencing landlord-tenant problems. This increased appropriation back in 14-15 allowed Homeline to expand statewide and serve people throughout the state of Minnesota who have landlord-tenant problems that are affecting them. The second of these items is for a group called Open Access, and they provide access to cell phones and computers for people who are experiencing homelessness, so that, for example, they have the ability to make appointments and go for job interviews, et cetera. Very helpful. And again, this increase allowed them to expand statewide. We anticipate that we would continue to fund both Homeline and Open Access at these levels, simply rolling them into the broader capacity building category so that we can make adjustments in the future if markets warrant that to happen. We have spoken with both Homeline and Open Access about this change. We are also recommending that $350,000 be moved out of capacity building into the Housing Trust Fund. These funds were designated in the 14-15 budget for a group called Voice of East African Women for the capital costs of creating a shelter, and that has now occurred. That shelter has been acquired. And we do not provide, through Minnesota Housing, ongoing operating dollars for shelters. That is provided typically through the Department of Public Safety and through their shelter program, typically for people who are victims of domestic violence. Thank you. And so we thought it best to take these dollars and ask that they be reallocated to our Housing Trust Fund, which is a program that serves very low-income and vulnerable populations. So with that, concludes our proposal. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. And I'll let you take a moment to catch your breath. I know that we do have a couple of questions. I do have a quorum here as well. So what I'd like to do is to, I see Representative Lunan has moved that we move the minutes from February 16th. I'm just wondering if the members have any questions regarding the minutes. Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes from February 16th signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That carries. Member questions. Representative Scott, please, for Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and please bear with me. I have several questions. I don't know whether to go front to back or back to front, but since we left off on the governor's budget changes, on the last slide, where you have the program reallocations, the $540 for capacity building, could you get us a breakdown of how much is how much would go into each of those two programs, the home program or the Homeline program and the Open Access? Is that possible?
It was equal, 270 to each.
Okay, divided equally. Okay.
Representative Scott?
Yep. Just a minute. I'm writing down here. In the slide right above that, where you're having this database, a centralized database, what kind of data are you gathering for these folks or on these folks?
Commissioner Tinkerthal.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there's a variety of data depending on the program where they enter the system. Where there is private data that is collected, that is very closely protected by state privacy provisions. And any data that would be shared more generally would be done on a de-identified or an aggregate basis.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm wondering, the people that you're collecting the data on, have they signed consent forms? Has there been any sort of a Tennyson warning given to those folks?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, yes, indeed.
Okay. And
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And who do you share that data with? Is it just other programs? Is there another, other state agencies? Who are you sharing that data with?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, the data is reported most directly to HUD, which provides the financing for the bulk of the programs. As I mentioned, there are several state agencies, including Minnesota Housing, that collect data specifically on the program that we are administering. So, for example, our Housing Trust Fund rental assistance program, any data on individuals who receive that assistance is reported to Minnesota Housing. There are a couple of very stringently written data sharing agreements between ourselves and DHS where we are combining resources to serve a given individual. But those have been very carefully and written with heavy scrutiny to make sure that those data sharing agreements are put in place with regard to all state law.
Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Madam Commissioner, do you have some sort of an audit trail, and are periodic audits done to make sure that no one is accessing the data that shouldn't be accessing the data?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, I can speak only for Minnesota Housing, and I will tell you that we go through a very, very thorough data and systems audit every year. We use an outside our outside accounting firm that also does our financial accounting. They have a specific data integrity and data security, and we just, in fact, completed our review for last year. We have had an outstanding record of having very secure systems at Minnesota Housing.
Great. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
This yeah, Representative Scott, no worries.
Several more questions. I don't know. Oh, we can barely see the slide numbers there. I think it might be slide 12, Governor's Budget Changes. And I had just some questions about this program for folks with mental illness. And I've talked to some landlords who have housing, and I don't know if it's for this specific program or not, the Bridges program, but they do have housing that they've made available to people with mental illnesses. And it's my understanding, Madam Commissioner, that those folks have someone that check on them on a fairly regular basis. Would this be that program?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, yes, that would be this program, and that's where we indicated that we do partner with the Department of Human Services to make sure that when someone does receive rental assistance through the Bridges program, that they have the social service dollars to go with them to provide that kind of service. Also, there's often sort of an ombudsman role where not only can the individual tap into those resources, but if the landlord has an issue, they also know that they can call that ombudsman if necessary to help resolve issues.
Thank
Representative
you,
Scott.
And Madam Chair, thank you. One of the landlords that I've spoken to about this has ran into problems in a particular city because these folks, even though the city requires them to do background checks, which they do, but knowing that these people were going to have some sort of oversight by someone from DHS or whatever, the landlord said, okay, you know, I'm willing to, you know, as long as these people are going to be overseen. Well, the city is getting very upset because there are continual police calls. And so they're coming down on the landlord for letting these folks live, you know, where they're living. And I don't know, is this something that you've heard of before?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I have not heard that, and we'd be happy to follow up with you, get the information, and see if we can connect the dots on that one.
That would be great. I could for sure let you know what city it was.
Great.
Was having a problem. Then I want to turn the corner here a little bit on your budget. And I have this, your annual report, and I don't see either an income statement or a balance sheet in there. Is that something that could be provided?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, yes, we do have audited financial statements for the agency, and we'd be happy to provide you and others with copies of that.
Wonderful. Thank you. And one last question.
Representative Scott, go ahead.
I have a sheet that's entitled 2014 Minnesota Housing Affordable Housing Program Allocation of Gap Funding. And I'm looking through this, and I see that there's these agency pools, agency pool 2 and 3. Could you kind of give me an idea what those pools are? I can bring this forward so you know what I'm talking about.
Commissioner Tingerthal, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, yes, each year we develop something that we call our Affordable Housing Plan, which is our programmatic spending plan for the coming year. We adopt that by our board in September after a series of public hearings and getting a good deal of input on how we should allocate those dollars. And some of the resources, and if I can call your attention back to slide number 2. Down in the lower right-hand corner, the orange triangle called Agency Resources for Amortizing Loans. 8%.
Okay.
That is also, we refer to that by shorthand as Pool 2. So those are loans that we actually make from resources that we have on the agency's balance sheet. So we're essentially, in some ways, a bank. So we have resources. We make loans. We often issue debt to support those loans, bonds, and we get the payments, and we use the payments to retire the debt we use to raise the capital for those loans.
Okay.
So that's what we call Pool 2.
Okay.
And then where you see agency resources for deferred loans, 3%, right at the very bottom, that little, the smallest of the triangles, that is what we call in our shorthand Pool 3. And what Pool 3 is, it's a built-in mechanism that within Minnesota Housing, because we do have a balance sheet and we are a bit of a bank and we do manage $3 billion worth of assets, we are often fortunate enough to actually have net income. And Pool 3 is the mechanism that we use for taking that net income and plowing it back into authorized agency programs. So we actually bring any net income that we have into our programmatic spending for the following year.
Thank you. And
one Representative last Scott, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. Madam Commissioner, if there's a Pool 2 and a Pool 3, is there a Pool 1?
That's a frequent question. There is a Pool 1, and that is simply where we manage our operating resources. So that's just sort of think of that as our general ledger.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger. Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Deputy Commissioner.
To one of Representative Scott's earlier questions, the $540,000 that was allocated to Homeline and Open Access, it was $400,000 to Homeline and $140,000 to Open Access. So just a slight correction on the numbers.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to spin back for a minute on the question about the data.
Yes, go ahead.
How long do you keep those data sets for?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am afraid I do not know the answer to that question, but we can certainly find out and get back to you.
Representative Neuberger.
I think that would be nice, and I think Representative Scott would also like to be included on that email. You just email that to us. I did have a question. I know there are other folks that want to ask questions, so I'll be quick. On the open access part of your program.
Go ahead.
How many computers and cell phones have been delegated out in the past year, 2 years, or how many pieces of hardware have you given out,
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, I am afraid I don't know the answer to that one either, but we'll be happy to get that for you.
Representative Neuberger?
I look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I'm looking for is for you to help us understand your thinking when you're looking at a particular balance. And that is between building a lot of units or rehabbing a lot of rental units and the long-term operating costs that either the state pays or a resident pays, like heating and stuff like that. So the question would be efficiency now or lots more building, lots more units now, and where is the balance and what drives your thinking there?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, for some time now we have adopted, particularly for our multifamily new construction and rehab properties, a set of standards that are known as the Enterprise Community Green Standards. And they address a wide array of site-specific building standards and landscaping, et cetera, planning standards. And Enterprise Communities is a national organization that has worked in the affordable housing development field for 30 years and has done considerable research on the energy conservation and water conservation aspects of rental housing. And so we've looked at a number of different standards and have found that this set of so-called green standards seems to be the most appropriate fit for us. And we do require that any rental property that receives funding through us meet those green standards.
Representative Wagenius.
Two follow-ups.
Yep.
So for these, when you have a multi-unit building, do you require or have each water meter for each unit, electric meter for each unit? I think gas is probably hard. Gas you could do, but if it's heating, it's probably hard. But do you require individual units or individual meters for the ones where it's pretty easy?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, I am not well versed in the actual specifications of the green standards, but we can certainly get back to you on that. I know that individual metering is sometimes a very effective way for individuals to manage their own energy conservation, where it's tougher to do if it's master metered. I really just don't know what the standard is within the green standards.
Well, that would be helpful.
And a follow-up. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so as I am looking at the answer to my question, one of the ways I could see it is if there was a line item in the budget, a TAO, for operating costs, and I just can't see that line item in this budget. Most of the places have that kind of line item where we would see exactly what operating expenses we could anticipate going out years. So am I missing something here as I'm looking at the budget, or is there not that line item that I can see?
Commissioner Tinkerthal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, as I mentioned, Minnesota Housing does not own any housing, and so none of these buildings are owned by the state of Minnesota. They are each individually underwritten to look at the long-term operations of those buildings, and certainly utility costs is one of those things that we look at to ensure that the building owner, that the rents that can be charged by the building can pay the operating expenses over the long term. And we frequently have discussions with building developers who are including perhaps a higher standard of energy efficiency to look at lower operating costs over time. And it all plays into how well the rents for that property can support a mortgage or other financing over time.
Thank you. And one more follow-up. Go ahead. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
So there is no state underwriting of any of the rents at any time in the future. No state participation in any way in any of this housing in supporting payments, mortgages, rents, or anything. Is that what you're telling me?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, if I understand your question, that is correct. We will frequently put in a piece of money as a deferred loan up front when that loan closes, when the property is either built or rehabilitated. After that point, the state of Minnesota and Minnesota Housing have no ongoing obligations to pay utilities or rent assistance, etc. You know, our obligation is paid up front.
And health department doesn't pay anything, and nobody else does, so we're home free.
Correct.
Okay, thank
Very
you.
Good. We have two more members with questions. Representative Gunther, and then on deck is Representative Mahoney. So, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Tingerthal, it's good to see you again. You and I have been working on affordable workforce housing for quite a while, ever since we met each other. And there seems to be a few barriers to having that built, especially in greater Minnesota. And one of them is finding lenders to lend money to contractors who want to build like an apartment building or affordable housing duplex or whatever. Is there any relief that we can give them for that in any way? We buy down interest or anything of that kind of thing?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther, as I noted in my presentation, we have indeed been busy building workforce housing throughout Minnesota for a number of years. And what I would say is that we don't have any set recipe in terms of the kind of funding that goes into the total development cost of a particular rental project. So, for example, we will provide from Minnesota Housing a first mortgage loan if there is not a lender that will provide that first mortgage loan locally. We also have the ability to use dollars from the Challenge Fund to provide some gap financing so that if between the amount of equity that the developer brings to the table and the amount of debt that they can support, if there's a gap, that is exactly what the Challenge Fund is intended to be used for. So I think we have a great deal of ability to work with local communities to frame up projects that meet their needs and be able to provide the financing without necessarily needing to rely on lenders if they're uncomfortable lending in a market.
And a follow-up, Representative Gunther?
Yes, I do. Thank you. I know we have a tremendous shortage of rental housing in the metro area, and it's a big concern of mine because people just can't find an apartment, and prices are atrocious. I'd hate to tell you what I'm paying. But Greater Minnesota has somewhat the same thing, where there is a growing business like Digi-Key and Thief River and Echo and Jackson and Suzlon and Pipestone. I look at those three examples. If we don't find some way to get affordable rental housing for not only the metro area, but also in certain key areas in greater Minnesota. And what I'm hearing from the lenders is, are we sure this company is going to stay here and continue to grow? And I tell them my crystal ball broke last week. But, you know, you really look at, there should be something, and I'm glad you gave me a couple examples. We got to figure out something that we can have more rental housing, not only in the metro area, and it's hard to believe with all these houses they need something, but they do. And so if we used to have a federal program to help things like that out. I think HUD died. They didn't give him a funeral, though. It really is tougher now than ever before. So if you can figure out something to do, we'll build a plaque for you. But
thank you, Representative. I'm going to take it over to our, hopefully, our final question here, and we can move on to our next presentation. So Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, you know, we've had a whole bunch of housing bills come through the committees this year. You know, other than, I think I've heard, the only issue I've heard more of is solar energy than housing. And I don't build houses and I don't use solar energy in my home. So I do have a question, though. I'm sure you've been following all these housing bills. There was one introduced today, House File 749, and I was just able to, you know, get through a little bit of it, but it really looks like it's a $50 million bill for housing in Greater Minnesota, and I'm not sure when the chairman is planning on hearing it. The hot rumor mill was on Monday. But it certainly looks like it's your challenge grant or something that could be done through the challenge grant. So I'm hoping that you'll get a chance to read House File 749 and yourself or one of your representatives will be here on Monday so that we can find out if you could actually do all of this that's in this bill through your challenge grant, because it looks like it's creating another program or group indeed to administer housing in a program that's identical to what you do, only for a higher value home. So it's not really a question, but I'm just asking you to take a look at that bill and be here Monday to comment on it if it comes up or whenever it does come up.
Representative Mahoney, are you sure that's the right House File number? It's 749. We don't have it on our list. It was just introduced today. Oh, okay. Thank you very much. Commissioner, did you want to respond to Representative Mahoney?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney will be happy to look at the bill and be happy to be available for question if the committee wishes.
Thank you very much. And again, we really appreciate your testimony today. Yes, Deputy Commissioner.
Yes, Mr. Chair, to a question from Representative Simonson about open access. Open access just provides free voicemail to people experiencing homelessness. They don't actually provide the cell phones or any laptops for the individuals.
Thank you.
Sorry for that misinformation.
No worries. I think that was Representative Neuberger that had the question, okay. So I want to correct the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I wasn't listening because I heard Simonson, so I just ignored it.
Would you like him to repeat that for your Mr. No, we're fine. Anyway, thank you both very much for your testimony today. Thank you so much. Oh, I'm sorry, we have one more question. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry I came in late from the session, but did you get a chance to brag a little bit about what you're doing with, I think when I came in they were talking about Pool 1 and Pool 2, and some of the work that we're doing to try to deal with the disparities in homeownership, racial disparities, because I think it's something you really deserve some credit for, and it helps our homeowners both throughout Minnesota, both metro and greater Minnesota. And did I miss that? Did you already get a chance to talk about that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, we did not specifically this time talk about disparities. We did, however, on Friday of last week, we filed a report that was required by the last legislative session on our work on closing the disparities gap between white households and households of color. And, you know, we did submit that to the chairs of this committee. Be happy to provide copies to all members of the committee if you're interested in seeing that.
We would appreciate that. Thank you very much. And one final follow-up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess maybe I'll beg on your behalf then, because Minnesota went from being the worst state in the whole nation in terms of racial disparities in home ownership to, with the project that they worked on through the one of the pools, being the third. So we're getting better, and I think we can only go up, but I'm just very grateful for that beginning, and your leadership was really important in making that happen.
Thank you very much. And again, thank you both for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see. Next up, we have the Office of Deed here. So if you would please come forward and introduce yourself for the record, please. And welcome, gentlemen. All right, welcome, and you can proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Kevin McKinnon. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Economic Development at Deed, and I'm joined today by my colleagues, Deputy Commissioner Jeremy Hanson Willis from our Workforce Division, and Deputy Commissioner Blake Chafee, who is our Deputy of Operations. Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and members, we appreciate the opportunity to be here today to present the governor's budget and the change items within. We are pleased, obviously, to share that the governor remains focused on important investments to ensure Minnesota's economic prosperity now and into the future. Thank you. And with this proposal, the governor invests in Deed's border-to-border broadband program, workforce development efforts, while maintaining investments made in previous biennium for economic development. Next slide, please. We're going to tag team this presentation here today. So the first one we'll start with is the broadband infrastructure program.
Do you want to? Should we make sure the technology's up and running? I know that we're having issues, but I do know that we do have a handout here, too.
Sure. Yeah.
Yep, there we go. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. So we can go to slide three. In the governor's budget, we're recommending $30 million for the border-to-border grant program. Back in 2010, policymakers set a number of visionary goals. Number one, to achieve border-to-border access to moderate levels of broadband service to every home in the state by 2015. And number two, achieving a top ranking among states in the adoption and the use of broadband technologies. These goals recognize that broadband is frequently been called the key transportation infrastructure of the 21st century, much as roads, railroads, and the highway systems have been in the past. At present, about 75% of Minnesota households have access to broadband at or above state speed goals. Over 450,000 households still need such service. While the statutory goals currently include a deadline of 2015, waiting until a future budget cycle to invest additional resources would make future efforts even more difficult and allow significant momentum that is built on these issues to dissipate. Given the importance of broadband access to businesses of all sizes and to the communities that they locate in, the governor recommends $30 million in fiscal year 2016 available over the biennium for the border-to-border broadband infrastructure grant program. This program was established in the 2014 legislative session. This pool of funding would be awarded through a competitive grant process, and it'd be based on the program's inaugural grant round in 2014, of which the awards were just released. In that 2014 grant round, we utilized the $20 million one-time appropriation from the last session. It was all distributed in a single competitive grant round. Within that, we had a cap of $5 million per award. We required at least a one-to-one match, 50% of eligible expenses. The grant awards were to be geographically dispersed, and eligible locations had to be unserved or underserved. Another key point here was the technology must be scalable to at least 100 megabits up and down. Applications and requests that we received in the 2014 grant round, we had 40 applications filed. All areas of the state were represented. Applicants included telephone companies, cable companies, fixed wireless, newly created entities, cooperatives, and municipalities and counties. Grants requested were $44 million, and the total eligible project costs that we determined were almost $100 million. Our awards for 2014 were 17 projects. Total grant funding that went out was $19,400,000. The local match that this created, almost $26 million for a total investment value of just over $45 million for this program. Well, we know that estimates for the statewide cost of achieving broadband goals are much higher, somewhere between $900 million and $3 billion. This proposal anticipates that Minnesota would continue to be just one of several contributors towards closing this gap. Private providers, namely, will continue to serve some of our underserved areas where they can achieve strong returns on their investments. This proposal will help DEED continue addressing the needs left unmet by the private sector in areas not otherwise on providers' investment horizon. This amount, actually the $30 million, was further informed by discussions with and between many stakeholder groups and communities that we have, including the Governor's Broadband Task Force, legislators, the Sub-Cabinet on Broadband, over 40 local governments and providers, the Congressional Delegation, and multiple federal agencies. This proposal is a major investment that addresses a major problem and one that must be solved for the sake of our economy. So what will this proposal do? Per statute, this proposal will assist in the development of significant new broadband infrastructure, defined as the acquisition and installation of middle-mile and last-mile infrastructure that support broadband service scalable to speeds of at least 100 megabits per second download and 100 megabits per second upload for Minnesotans who would otherwise be unable to access quality broadband service. By reserving a portion of these funds also for administrative costs, DEED will be able to cover the essential data and mapping functions that help inform how we deploy these resources. DEED expects to serve under 6,100 households with the fiscal year 15 allocation of $20 million. Using the same baseline, the appropriation of $30 million would serve about 8,500 households of the current 450,000 unserved households across the state. Ultimately, this proposal will increase the capacity of the private sector businesses and individuals to innovate and introduce new ideas by increasing their technological capacity, providing access to vast new informational resources, strengthening communities as a place to do business, and providing greater access to markets outside immediate geographic boundaries.
Deputy Commissioner, we have a couple of questions at the table. First one actually comes from me. Are you able to present the awards today to the committee as far as where the awards went, this first round of the $20 million, and maybe more specifically, the cost per, what award or the rewards, that kind of thing. So is that able to be passed out?
Mr. Chair, I believe we can do that today.
Okay. Thank you. We can do that when it's convenient for you. So that's my question. We also have other members with questions as well. So Representative Metz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My point was actually going to be to compliment the work that was done by Dana and the agency. I know last year, in kind of coming to terms with making this a package that, I believe would work for greater Minnesota, working with all the vested agencies, I guess, and partners on it, was quite an accomplishment to actually see it out and go hit those unserved homes, and I believe the percentages all over look good. We're chipping away, making progress, making sure people who didn't have internet are getting it, and so I think this is a good solid investment, and got my support to continue on, and our Chairman Johnson here has a good bill out asking for a few more dollars, so I hope we can find a few more dollars for you to work with.
Thank you. And Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That $30 million, does that also include operational money for the Office of Broadband? Is that included in that?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, we also have $250,000, which is in the base budget for the operational aspect of the office. We do have the 3% of the $30 million that is used for the mapping and data collection. Mm-hmm. Whether we use that entire 3%, if we do not use the entire 3%, the remainder would go into additional grants.
Follow-up, Representative?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And similar to Representative Metz, I've been impressed with the work that has gone on in the Office of Broadband, particularly with Dana McKenzie. I see she's in the audience there. She's been a real stand-up person to work with and move forward these broadband issues. Now, if I see the FCC recently changed their definition of broadband to 25 megabits down and I think 3 up, what would that do for coverage of Minnesota if, in fact, we use what is now the federal definition of broadband? Currently, it looks like the coverage is around 78% if you don't include wireless, and I think 89% with wireless, something like that. Do you have any idea what coverage would be using FCC standards?
Deputy Commissioner McKinnon.
Mr. Chair, if I may ask our Director of Broadband, Dana McKenzie, to come up and address that question.
Absolutely. And again, if I could speak as well, it sounded like you didn't have a copy of the awards, but what I was asked the committee administrator to do is just if you could provide the committee with a full list of that at a future time. Maybe we have a Monday, I think, Monday meeting coming up. So if we could be provided that at our next meeting, that would be great, all the broadband awards. So thank you for that.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And actually, I do have a copy, and I will leave it with the committee administrator.
Oh, perfect.
So that can be distributed.
Better yet.
And Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, yes. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Dana McKenzie, Executive Director of the Office of Broadband Development. Thank you.
And welcome.
Representative, I believe the question was regarding the impact of the new FCC standard on the 25 megabits down, 3 megabits up. Interestingly, because of the standard that Minnesota set, the map that will be portrayed using the new FCC standard will look remarkably similar to the map that Minnesota's already operating under using their standards, and that has to do with the slightly more aggressive upload speeds that are part of Minnesota's goal, which really gets at the economic development impacts of the investments we're making. So while we do not have that map in place at this moment, the office is working on putting that together, so the next time that we talk about this issue, we'll have that for you. But we have noticed not a marked change because of the bar we had already set for the state.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you. And thank you, Dana. Appreciate that. All right, please continue with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, members, again, my name is Jeremy Hansen-Willis, Deputy Commissioner for DEED for Workforce Development, and I'll be talking about the next grouping of proposals related to workforce development coming from the governor's budget. As you know, Minnesota's economy, as we've talked about before in this committee, is continuing to grow with a very low unemployment rate around the state. Unfortunately, at the same time as we're experiencing this economic growth, we know that not all of that prosperity is being shared evenly around the state. And with many populations still experiencing unemployment and a difficulty finding employment. We also know that the demographic shifts happening in our state as our population continues to age into retirement will result in labor shortages all across the state, and many of our businesses today are already experiencing these labor shortages. These are some of the challenges that we tried to respond to with the proposal that we have before you today. Simply put, we know that Minnesota's employers need Minnesotans who are ready to meet the demands of their growing businesses and economies to help not only them grow, but also help the livelihood of their families in the process. To better serve educationally underprepared, low-skilled adults, we propose creating a new, single, competitively awarded Career Pathways program. The program would be called Pathways to Prosperity and would combine two of our existing programs, the Fast Track Career Pathways and the Adult Workforce Competitive Grant Programs. So currently, as I mentioned, we have two programs, the Adult Career Pathways, the Fast Track Career Pathways, and the Adult Competitive Programs. Fast Track Career Pathways helps educationally underprepared adults succeed in well-paying careers by integrating basic skills education, career-specific training in fields where new skills are in high demand. Significantly, the establishment of this program in close partnership with the philanthropic sector, brought our workforce development system into the broader career pathways movement that's become the model nationwide, an approach that has gained strong support nationally. As the Minnesota Fast Track program has matured, it has become strong and widely supported. We have also had great success in our adult competitive grant program, which brings grant funding to workforce development service providers throughout the state on a competitive basis. These funds are also targeted to serve job seekers who have barriers to employment and targets populations identified to have employment disparities, such as minority populations, veterans, older workers, Minnesotans in transition from public assistance or incarceration, workers with disabilities, including individuals who are deaf or hard of hearing. In serving these populations, nonprofit providers focus on employment assistance, such as job training, job placement, and job readiness skills. So we propose to combine these two programs into a new career pathways program called Pathways to Prosperity, which would reflect the common mission and goals of these very similar programs to make more resources available to nonprofit organizations and customers in a more efficient and effective manner, and reflect the lessons learned from these programs over the recent years. As with these two existing programs, the unified new program, Pathways to Prosperity, would focus on providing services to those unemployed adults with barriers to employment. So key components of this new program would include remedial education, skills-based and credential training, placement and retention in jobs that pay high enough wages to sustain families, and would focus on the industry needs and the training of the occupations to meet the needs of our economy and those sectors of our economy that are growing fastest today. And of course, success would be measured by clear employment outcomes. As I said, to fund this new program, the governor recommends combining these existing programs. The Adult Workforce Competitive Grant Program, funding of $6.5 million over the biennium, and the Fast Track Program of $3 million over the biennium. We would also redirect $2.5 million from the Workforce Development Fund for a grand total of just over $12 million of existing dollars that would be directed into this new program between General Fund and Workforce Development Fund dollars.
Deputy Commissioner, we have a couple questions from the members. Representative Fabian, he's going to pass, and Representative Lunin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, when I look at this pathway to prosperity, I have a background as a school board member, and the things you're doing here are things that are supposed to be going on in public education, and obviously with some individuals are not. And I'm not saying that this is bad. I'm just saying that some things are getting attempted or paid for three times. We're doing it at the public school level. We're doing it here. And there's individuals that when they go to college and have to take remedial classes that they themselves pay tuition for, it's a third time we're paying for it. Now, you cannot teach someone who will not learn. So I'm not taking a shot at this. What I'm taking a shot at is when we spend money in public education, and it would be easier to teach a cat to bark than to get these kids to do their work, to do the work that what it takes to learn. They're just, for whatever reason, and we could talk about that late, is they aren't ready, and you're contending that they're ready now. And let's just get rid of one of them. That's my statement.
Not a question, a statement, Representative Loon?
That was a statement.
Okay. We'll work on the cat learning how to bark soon, but thank you for that. Representative Isaacson has a question.
Well, I don't have a question as much as I would really question the merits of getting rid of one of them if it was that easy and simple. It's a really nice sounding piece of rhetoric that looks good on a lit piece, but the reality is it's very complex measures going into all three of those. And I certainly wouldn't want to see us forsaking a very important part of the process. And so I hope that that wasn't your intent when saying what you just said.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, let me clarify that I think there's a point at which, certainly we saw it in the district I come from, that the problem we had with people not prevailing test-wise was a very, very, very strong correlation where they weren't even doing their work. And if that's the case, at some point, we just have to wait until they're ready. Once the student is ready, then the teacher arrives, and I just see this as a. And I'm not saying this is bad. I actually think this has a chance to be effective, simply because the market that you're going to are going to be ready for, are much more prepared for this than some of the things we're doing at the high school level. That was my point.
Thank you. We'll let our testifiers go ahead. So please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next step proposal that I'd like to talk about has to do with incumbent worker training. And is our attempt simply to reflect not only the current economic demands, but also new federal legislation that was adopted last summer. And in order to meet our workforce development system needs, we need to be more agile and responsive to the economy to prevent layoffs, address barriers to employment and economic growth, and expand our talent pool overall. Incumbent worker training, or the training of existing workers, and the skills development of these current employees is key to the businesses and the employers that employ them. While dislocated workers, people who lose their job through no fault of their own, will always be a priority for us at DEED, and funding dislocated worker supports should be preserved for those people in periods, especially of high unemployment. We need additional flexibility in order to meet the employer needs right now at a time of high growth and economic expansion. Second of all, the federal government last year has also identified incumbent worker training as the need for dislocated worker programs nationwide, representing a shift in the need during an economy for how state agencies should respond to their needs. And so as we see going from a recession economy to a growth economy, we would like the flexibility reflected also in federal legislation to be able to use dislocated worker funds for incumbent worker training. So to meet these needs, we propose adding a new allowable use for the dislocated worker program to also serve incumbent workers. And again, incumbent workers are those who are currently employed and would benefit from enhanced skills training and increased productivity. Adding this flexibility to the possible uses of the Dislocated Worker Program Fund would provide businesses in Minnesota with a significant new resource to support training to retain and develop their current employees. And our workers would benefit from the chance to enhance their skills on the job and advance with their current career paths. Because of the many advantages of this approach, there is extremely high demand right now for incumbent worker training, especially at a time of low unemployment and difficulty of hiring for many of our employers. So we expect that these services would particularly benefit small businesses as they develop succession plans for their rapidly aging workforce. The funding would also leverage significant private sector investment in workforce development, since it would, of course, be matched dollar by dollar from the employers. So with this proposal, it would help Minnesota's workforce development system meet the labor market needs and be more agile and responsive to prevent layoffs, address barriers to economic growth, and expand our existing talent pool. It would also reflect, as I said, federal legislation. So given Minnesota's dramatically improved economy, this change will help us be much more responsive and flexible to the needs of our economy. Also, this fiscal impact would be neutral, and we're simply looking for more flexibility to respond to the economic needs.
Mr. Hanson-Willis, we do have a question from Representative Mahoney, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you speak to incumbent training coming out of workforce development funds. So who determines what? Currently, if there's incumbent worker training, it more often than not goes through the Job Skills Partnership. Where will this money be going, and who will be saying that's a good use of the dollars and that's not a good use of the dollars? Because frankly, the state has no business willy-nilly handing out money to employers for training. That's part of their job, unless it has some benefit to the state.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the funds would come from the, what we're asking for is out of the Workforce Development Fund, the Dislocated Worker Funds, which would still be a priority for us. And we want to make sure that we preserve enough of those funds should people lose their job through no fault of their own, that they have the support and training that they need to get back into employment. That would continue to be a very high priority. But you're correct in stating that the Job Skills Partnership Board, which we also work with to direct dollars to incumbent worker training, So it would be up to the agency's responsibility working with the board to ensure that dollars that went into incumbent worker training were used effectively to meet the needs of our current employers.
Representative Mahoney.
I'm not sure what the hell you said. So does the Job Skills Partnership have control of this money or does it not? That's a yes or no.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the Job Skills Partnership Board does vote on expenditures out of this fund.
Out of any of these new dollars coming out of the workforce dollars
out
that
of
you're adding?
Mr. Chair.
Deputy Commissioner.
Out of the Workforce Development Fund for Dislocated Worker Training.
Representative Mahoney.
Okay, good. Now I've got one other question.
Go ahead, yes, please.
And I appreciate that. It's just I'm a really simple kind of guy, and I need yes or no answers. So I don't mean to be crabby, but
we've already learned that about you, so that's fine.
I was just trying to apologize without sounding too begging. Last year, this last couple of years, we've really put a focus on accountability in these workforce training programs. And I see there is some information on the workforce training programs in the budget documents that were handed out. It's not the complete package, and I know that you can go to the website and you can take a look at it. It's just a few of the programs that we have in the state. By the way, we have 160 workforce training programs. Indeed, the Jobs Committee only has control of about 9 of them. So it was just, I wanted to repeat, out of 160, we only have control of 9. Doesn't make much sense to me, but that's not your problem. So how are you using this information, the new tracking that we're doing, the net impact statements that we're doing, how are you using that to develop how you're moving forward in job training and what is a valuable piece and what is working and what's not working? So if you could just give me how you intend to use it or how you are using it.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. I'm going to refer to Representative Garofalo. Oh, I'm sorry. I had it wrong. I'm sorry. Deputy Commissioner.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney. I think that we use accountability measures very much as one of many tools that we look at to improve our programs. As you know, through the legislation that was adopted, we have created a report card to provide information both for ourselves and publicly in terms of the number of people who enter a program, who exit a program, the wages that they earn, and through these and other measures and feedback that we have received from the service providers, so we take all of that information in, which is why we believe that the two existing programs that we have, both the Fast Track and the Adult Competitive, actually perform very well in terms of providing people both credentials, employment, and higher wages than when they began the program. And we really think that by combining these programs, that we can continue that success, but also have administrative efficiency and ease for some of the service providers who sometimes apply to both grant funds unnecessarily, and there's unnecessary duplication. So from our perspective, while the accountability and performance metrics are very helpful, we believe that is partly why we should combine these programs together into a single program to continue that success. So I would say that the accountability measures, although we just have the 1 year from the recent report card, will absolutely guide us in terms of how we direct the programs. And again, as I said, the intention of the new Pathways to Prosperity in particular is to look at those populations with barriers to employment. The folks that are still unemployed today in this low unemployment economy are folks who have a lot of barriers in their lives and difficulty getting into employment. These are no longer the easy cases. These are folks with gaps in their resume or criminal history or real challenges with childcare and transportation. So these are not simple cases. So simply looking at wage data and employment data doesn't give you the full picture because you have to understand that these are individual people with families and lives. And so I think that the accountability measures are important. But we also have to look at, are these folks getting into the credentials and the jobs that they need to have self-sufficient wages for their family?
And back to Representative Mahoney.
You weren't here, but there was an attempt to get all that information, but it didn't quite get over that hump. The question I have is, I know you needed to get information from MFEB and Adult Basic Ed to do these report cards. Are you going to continue to get information from MFEB and the Adult Basic Ed people to continue expanding these report cards? Because this is really, you know, we go in as a committee handing out money to a lot of different nonprofits, and we really aren't sure whether we're getting good results or bad results. And I know that now any nonprofit that gets money has to put these reports in. So are you getting that information? So the question is, are you going to continue to include MFAP, Adult Basic Ed, and are you going to expand your report card to include anyone new that gets money, or anyone that got money this last year and just reports now?
Mr. Hanson-Willis.
Yes. Mr. Terrapson Mahoney. Yes.
Thank you. Another question, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to just take a minute to go back to the broadband development, the Office of Broadband Development, if they have a minute for a couple questions. We talked about this in a previous committee, but I want to make sure that I have my facts straight and that members of the committee understand this, that right now these broadband grants, it has to be wired. It has cannot be used for wireless, nor can it be used for satellite. Is that correct?
Mr. Hanson-Willis.
Or
Mr. McKinnon, maybe. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to actually have our Director Dana come up and answer that.
All right. Welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. We are at the Office of Broadband Development, we are administering the language of the broadband grant that was put into place. And the language of the grant does not limit the technology that is used in deploying the services that are receive grants. However, there are technical specifications that are defined in there, which includes 100 the ability to reach 100 megabits per second bidirectionally. And in looking at that, there are technologies that are more able to make the argument that they can meet those requirements. And so that's where that the issue that you raised probably comes into play.
Right. And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
And to the testifier, I just want to, again, we talked about this in a previous committee, but I have to repeat myself so everyone here knows, is that we're looking for these grants that have been awarded. There's a different definition of an endpoint, and that is that sometimes it may go into an area where later on they're going to add the final leg to a home or to a business. There's also places where the connections will actually go to the home. And the numbers that we have is that each internet hookup is costing the taxpayers in between $5,000 and $7,000 apiece, as we have designed the program. Is that a correct statement?
Ms. McKenna.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe the amount per passing, and you referenced this, that there are different definitions. Our definition of passing is either a household or a business. And on when you run the numbers on the investments that have been made, the per passing investment from state resources is closer to that a $3,000 number. I think the number that you may be using may be the total cost, which does include private investments and the matching funds. It is probably maybe where the number you're coming up with. And we can certainly, I'd be happy to talk with you offline and check where how we're arriving at those numbers.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Groffler.
So last year it was $30 million was the amount, and we've hooked up 6,100 endpoints. Are those correct numbers?
Ms. McKenna.
Mr. Chair, no, last year it was $20
million. Representative Groffler.
That's my swimming math is wrong then. Okay. So $20 million and then $30 million is this year's budget request by the government.
Ms. McKenna.
Mr. Chair, that is the correct.
And thank you. And I want to thank the office for the work they're doing. Again, they're implementing the statute that we, that the legislature has passed into law. But I would just ask members to think about this carefully, that while fiber optic cabling may seem like the right technical decision to make now, the reality is there are rapid investments in wireless, advancements and investments in wireless as well as satellite technology. And if you think about low-density environments or the ability to upscale infrastructure, digging a digging a channel in the ground and putting fiber optic cabling in place may not be the best way to be delivering high-speed bandwidth, either upload or download, to users. And specifically, when you're talking about scaling this technology and moving beyond where we're at today, it is clear the vast majority of research and development in the private sector is going into it's going into wireless, it's going into satellite. Within 2 years, there's going to be a new satellite service launching, private sector satellite service, that will give much better service to Minnesotans. Right now, with the wireless capabilities that come from one private sector wireless provider, today it's 10 meg download, 5 meg upload, certainly not 100 meg capabilities as we've put in statute and required staff to implement, but there are very few and far between practical applications needed for 100 megabits of upload and download service. And I appreciate the committee's indulgences from a network engineer in this stuff, but I think there's always danger when lawmakers try to prescribe specific technologies. Contrary to what has been stated by other people, fiber optic cabling is not future-proof. We do not know where the advances are going to be going. In fact, if I were betting my dollar on where broadband services are coming from, it's most likely to come from wireless and from satellite services. That's where the investments are going. And I think there's a very high possibility, very high risk of a possibility that 4 or 5 years from now we're going to look back at this program as some serious misinvestment and malinvestment of dollars, and that there's better ways to accomplish our goals than the hookup fees that we're doing right now for fiber. But that's not directed at the Office of Broadband Development. You guys are just doing your job. You're doing what the legislature told you to do. But I think there's some serious problems here, and over time it's going to demonstrate itself pretty severely.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. And also we've got a number of questions at the member table as well. We've got about 15, 16 minutes left. We may have to have you come back to finish it, but we'll see how the questions wrap up here. First up is Representative Gunther, and then we have Fabian after that.
I'll be very quick. Mr. Hanson Wolfs, Deputy Director, is that correct?
Deputy Commissioner Hanson.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
We used to have dislocated workers program described in a very definitive way in the past, and it was something that really made a lot of sense to me. And I encourage you to figure things like this out in this regard. Dislocated workers are trained in 12 weeks. They are hired at 80% of the salary from which they left, and it's a wonderful program. That's what you should want to say. That tells us exactly what the program does and how well it does. And that's what Representative Mahoney and I are used to.
Was that a question, Mr. Gunther? Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to circle back to the broadband infrastructure development slide to follow up on Representative Garofalo's questions. Anybody who knows me know that I'm not very techie there, Assistant Commissioner McKinnon. A couple of things that you stated. You talked about moderate levels, and then you also said state speed goals. Can you attempt to put that into language that I would understand?
Commissioner McKinnon.
Mr. Chair. Okay.
With that for Representative McKinnon. Fabian, speak very slowly.
So does that mean that Mr. McKinnon has the same technological knowledge that I do?
Probably.
Yeah, all right.
So maybe we'll let Ms. McKinnon take this one.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Just to restate the question, it's a little bit of background on what those state speed goals are.
Go ahead, I'm sorry, Representative Fabian.
Chair, the definition of moderate levels and the definition of state speed goals. And then my second question is going to be, is there a difference between homes and businesses?
Ms. McKenna.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The term moderate is being used to describe what is the current state speed goals, which were set into statute in 2010 based on some recommendations from a prior broadband task force set of findings. And those speed goals are 10 megabits per second down and 5 megabits per second up are the numbers. And at this stage, just for to put a little bit of context around that, at that time the FCC standard was 4 megabits down, for minimum was 4 megabits down, 1 megabit up. The FCC, as Representative Johnson brought up earlier, is now 25 megabits down and 3 megabits up. So when we use the term moderate, we're trying to describe its positioning in relationship to some of the other standards that have been set.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then, outside of fiber optic cables, are there other technologies currently available that deliver those speeds?
Ms. McKenna.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are technologies. A number of the applications that were awarded, in fact, utilize copper technologies to deliver speeds at that goal. In fact, I would say a large percentage of households in the United States are served over copper technology. There are wireless technologies that are also approaching that definitely can serve to those state speed standards as far as the future orientation of the language in the grant at the 100 meg. There are wireless technologies that are closely approaching that standard as well. So I believe the legislation was deliberately agnostic on what technology, and as are the evaluators when looking at the applications.
Anything else, Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just one final comment. When you live where Representative Metz and I live, you know, sometimes burying cables can be extremely expensive. It's a long distance between, you know, the connections and so forth. So I think that it is important to make sure that we do have an open mind to other technologies that will deliver things, especially in deep rural areas. Thank you.
Thank you, and over to Representative Metza, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just got my questions answered offline.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, I guess, to some of the comments of Representative Garofalo, I do think the, not necessarily in disagreement, but just to add, I guess, because the importance of not knowing what's coming up in the future certainly is a point well taken, because it is hard to know how communication is going to move forward. But I think the wireless fiber optic infrastructure provides a basis for a lot of the communications moving forward. For example, the wireless rides on the fiber optics. If you call someone on your cell phone from here up to International Falls, it's going to go to the towers and down in the fiber optics and then to the tower next to the cell phone that you're using up north somewhere. So it's not really necessarily an either or. I think it's a combination of, and as was stated, I think we do have to be open to all avenues, including satellite. That's not there yet clearly, but that could be an answer to some of these rural areas. Fixed wireless that can go 10, 15 miles perhaps, that might be an answer, but still, that 10, 50 miles, once it gets to the end point, it's going to go to a tower that's hooked up to fiber optic that's going to lead somewhere else. So it's kind of a combination.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. We've got Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And just, and again, I come from this from a technical perspective, not from a conservative or progressive or Republican or Democrat perspective. To make an analogy to members, what we are doing right now is we are building 8-lane interstates to people's houses. That is what the technological equivalent of what we are doing. We are going out and saying that to get from someone's house to where they need to go, we're going to put in a massive interstate to their house. And some of these people don't even have cars. Okay? That's what we're doing right now. And so there are better, more cost-effective ways to do this. I think that the goals that Representative Johnson and others have mentioned are completely admirable. You know, absolutely relevant that broadband is part of economic development. But if you look at worldwide capital investments, and even in the United States of America, the focus is not on bringing fixed fiber to low-density areas. That is not what people are doing. The investment, the research are in wireless. It's in satellite. Right now, certainly the satellite service we have right now, as Representative Johnson mentioned, it's limited in terms of the throughput ability, but that technology is going to continue to get better. And the tens of millions of dollars that have been invested very responsibly by the Office of Broadband Development, because they've done exactly what we've told them to do, that is
That's not where the sector is going. So let's, I'm done with my computer geek talk for the day. I'm done with the IT stuff. If I would, I would just encourage the legislature to. I now know what Representative Atkins feels like when I talk about law. So when I hear people talking about technology, so just please, happy to talk offline with people about this. But it's a really, there are more efficient ways to deliver these services.
And he's got a diagram here if you'd like to see it.
thank you, committee. And I think what we're going to do is we've got a couple members yet that want to ask a question, Representative Bouguinius and Mahoney. What I'd like to do is have the office finish their presentation, and I promise we'll get to their questions. But I want to make sure they finish up. So if you could please continue on, Mr. Hanson-Willis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just have a few more proposals to talk about, all related to how we serve the employment needs for people with disabilities. As you know, people with disabilities in Minnesota experience real and significant employment disparities. In 2012, about 12% of our population, age 16 and over, had a disability. And for this population, the employment rate is just over 26%, compared to more than 72% of the employment rate of the overall population. And so with unemployment, of course, comes disproportionately high levels of poverty among people with disabilities. And it's a missed opportunity for our businesses to tap into this very valuable talent pool. And so, indeed, we provide programs to support the long-term job and employment supports for this population with people with significant disabilities to help them get employment and to keep their jobs and advance their careers. We do this by helping them with job training and job-related tasks, dealing with schedule changes, adjusting to new supervisors and work environments. Key among these is our extended employment program. And we are requesting $500,000 for fiscal year 16-17 biennium, I'm sorry, for the biennium, in order to provide a one-time extended funding that was one-time funding extended into our base funding for the program. This $500,000 that was a one-time extension that we look to have go into the base reflects the rising costs that our local providers need in terms of staff and benefits for them to be able to provide these services around the state. And so if this one time is not continued into the base, it essentially would mean a 2% cut to the providers providing the service of job training for people with significant disabilities at the local level, meaning that they will struggle to maintain and would probably have to decrease the services that they provide to almost 5,000 people across the state. With 55% of people served by extended employment located in greater Minnesota, this rate reduction would have a disproportionate effect on those communities in greater Minnesota. Secondly is our individual placement and support program. In Minnesota, 85% of individuals served by public mental health systems are unemployed. 85% are unemployed. And for new Americans or Native Americans or African Americans who also fall into this category, the unemployment rate is 90%. We know through national research that work and employment is a critical component of recovery for people with serious mental illness, which is why we work to assist people with serious mental illness to achieve and maintain their employment in competitive jobs by providing ongoing counseling and job supports. We also know that through this effort in Minnesota, we have a 56% success rate to engage these individuals to get and maintain employment. The governor requests $2 million for the biennium to maintain the expansion of this individual placement program projects from 16 to 23 around the state that occurred during the last biennium. This extension, similarly to the last one, would be using one-time funding that would be extended into the next biennium. And so funding this again at a lower amount would mean a cut to services for people seeking and maintaining employment with severe mental illness. We also know that this is a core component of the Olmstead plan to respond to the Olmstead court case, that by June of 2015, the plan calls for the state to expand these exact IPS services in 17 counties. And without this funding, it would be a step back, and we would not be able to fulfill that expectation. And Minnesotans with severe mental illness would not gain access to employment that they need to be independent. The third and related effort relating to people with disabilities in our budget proposal has to do with the Olmstead implementation effort. As you know, and as we've talked about in this committee previously, as a result of the Olmstead and Jensen cases, Minnesota, over the last couple of years, has developed a comprehensive plan to meet a variety of different needs for people with disabilities. It includes not only DEED, but a number of other agencies. The funding for the Olmstead Implementation Office is in DEED's budget, and so we propose that it be adequately funded in order to engage in the interagency coordination, the accountability, the implementation, and the enforcement of the Olmstead effort. So trying to cut to the chase here, Mr. Chair, the governor proposes $850,000 in the biennium as an increase and $788,000 in the following biennium as an increase to run the Olmstead Implementation Office to ensure that the proper interagency coordination happens and that the plan is implemented and monitored accordingly. As you can imagine, significant coordination is required for this, and which is why we believe that this funding will be put to good use. Any questions on those three programs? Then lastly, and very briefly, a couple of other things that we would note that don't have significant fiscal impact, but could possibly. First is unemployment insurance advisory council recommendations that will come before you in much more detail at a later time, and some members of this committee sit on our Unemployment Insurance Advisory Committee and are well-versed, but we do have a number of recommendations that come out of our committee, which mostly relate to federal conformity, policy, and technical changes, which have the potential to have a minimal fiscal impact in the future. These changes will strengthen our unemployment insurance program, clarify and simplify statutory provisions, and make some necessary policy changes to eliminate and update unnecessary, outdated, or confusing language. So again, we'll come back to this committee another time to go through those, but we wanted to flag it for you here today because some of those programs could have a potential budget impact, although most likely negligible. There is a proposal in the governor's budget to recommend statutory protection from subpoena to our vocational rehabilitation services staff. On occasion, our VRS staff, through counseling Minnesotans, are sometimes served subpoenas 8 or 10 times a year. These circumstances vary, but often our staff are asked to testify in divorce proceedings, child support cases, or other criminal cases not related to the work of providing the services they have. And this takes an incredible amount of time, effort, and energy to respond to them. And so the governor is proposing statutory protections from subpoenas for our staff.
Very good. Thank you. What I would like to do, we've got some follow-up questions if we could wrap things up. We've got four members that would like to ask some questions, so if we could make it as brief as possible. Representative Wagenius has the first question.
Thank you. I'll just put my question on the table, and you will be back and perhaps hear from it, but I think it's for Deputy Commissioner Hanson Willis. You began talking with us about labor shortages, and you are talking about the folks who are here, but we heard when we were all at the Humphrey Institute, heard from the state demographer, that net Minnesota is losing its young population. I don't know who these people are. We need to know who these folks are. Are they the well-educated? We've already sunk a lot of money into them. And given the fact that we have a labor shortage, it seems to me we need to understand why, on net, we are losing the younger population. I think that's a discussion this committee has to, and they're statewide, so if we could have that conversation, I think that's important.
Mr. Hanson, do you want to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wagenius, I'm not familiar with that particular demographic information. I think you're absolutely right that we do have a labor shortage that's only going to grow over time as more of our population enters into retirement and leaves the workforce. And so we need to have a mentality of all hands on deck, where not a single Minnesotan is left behind or left to move to another state. Part of the focus of our programs at DEED is to make sure that the people who are in Minnesota are trained with the proper skills to meet the demands of our industry. And Mr. Chair, because we do have two other quick items, I think I will keep my answer short.
Thank you. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I question if we need an Olmstead office when I think the what used to be called MOHR, shelter workshops. Every one of those is going to have to pay $500,000 in order to stay in business. I think we should take care of them before we establish an Olmsted office in the Department of Deed. What do you think about that?
Representative Hanson Willis. I'm sorry, Commissioner.
Sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, I'm not familiar with the MOHR, but I am familiar with the Olmsted plan.
How about macro? Does that help you?
I'm sorry.
That's what it was last year.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, as we've talked about, and I think there will be another opportunity to talk in more detail about the implications of the Olmsted plan, and as a result of the court cases and the plan that has been developed, it is an extremely far-reaching plan, and both the state and federal courts are keeping an eye on how Minnesota progresses on this plan. There are 8 different agencies that are involved in this effort, and the plan involves not only employment, but housing, transportation, health care, a variety of services to help ensure that Minnesotans with disabilities are in non-isolated settings. And due to the nature of the plan, not only do we have to coordinate these activities of the interagency agreement and all the work happening between different agencies, there's a huge monitoring effort to make sure that all of the activities that are laid out in the plan are actually making progress, and we need to report back to the court on a very regular basis. We're also undertaking a quality of life assessment to ensure that we actually are improving the quality of life for Minnesotans with disabilities. That is a significant effort, and so the body of work here is above and beyond the current work underway, and the Olmsted plan does call for the creation of the office itself, and we believe that this funding is required. And I think the executive director of the Olmsted Implementation Office and the chair of the Olmsted Subcabinet and I would be very happy to come back and talk in more detail about how this would work between all the agencies. In this case, DEED is the fiscal agent. The money comes to our department and we house it, but the leadership and how decisions are made are not shared, are shared more broadly than by us alone.
Thank you, Mr. Hanson. I think what we'll do is have you come back as well to talk more about the Olmsted plan. We've got one more question from Representative Mahoney, if it could be ever so brief, sir.
No.
We're all set. Okay, well, very good. Thank you. We will have Deed back again. Thank you for your testimony today. I also want to thank the folks from the Minnesota Housing Finance. And with that, our meeting is adjourned.